bigoted, pious, contemptuous, selfish, unforgiving, spoiled, rigid, patronizing, judgmental, and in milder forms, pigeonholing. Intellectual pride leads to ignorance, and spiritual pride is the main block to spiritual development and maturation in everyone. Religious pride, by self-identification with the righteous and having the only true way, is the basis of all religious wars, rivalry, and dismal occurrences, such as the Inquisition. The biggest downfall of all is religious pride, and considering oneself entitled to kill others who don't share one's specific beliefs. In all of us, the prideful feeling, "I have the answers," blocks our growth and development. It is interesting that the egotistical part of the mind is willing to sacrifice the whole remainder of a person for its own sake. Rather than admit to being wrong, people will literally give up the life of the body itself and sacrifice any aspect of life on the altar of pride, e.g., religious wars and crusades. Male pride about those programs that our society considers masculine blocks the emotional and psychological inner development of most men in our society. Some women are now joining the ranks of chauvinism, which only compounds the problem and intensifies the battle of the sexes. Vulnerability of pride. The prideful person is constantly on the defensive because of the vulnerability of inflation and denial. Conversely, the humble person cannot be humiliated, for they are immune to vulnerability, having let go of pride. In its place, they have an inner security and self-esteem. Many people try to substitute pride for genuine self-esteem. However, genuine self-esteem does not actually arise until pride is relinquished. That which inflates the ego does not result in inner strength. On the contrary, it increases our vulnerability and overall level of fear. When we are in a state of pride, our energy is dissipated by the constant preoccupation with defending our lifestyle, vocation, neighborhood, clothes, year and make of car, ancestry, country, and political and religious belief systems. There is a tireless preoccupation with appearance and what other people will think, so there is a constant vulnerability to the opinions of others. When pride and self-inflation have been relinquished, there is an inner security that takes their place. When we no longer feel called upon to defend our image, criticisms and attacks from others diminish and finally stop. When we let go of our need for validation or to prove ourselves right, then the challenges against us fall away. This brings us to one of the basic laws of consciousness. Defensiveness invites attack. An examination of the nature of pride facilitates the letting go of it, as it is no longer valued. It is seen for what it is, in truth, weak. The dictum, "pride goeth before a fall," prevails. Pride is thin ice, a poor substitute for that rock-like, real strength that comes from courage, acceptance, or peace. Is there such a thing as healthy pride? When we talk of healthy pride, we are referring to self-esteem, an inner awareness of one's true value and worth. This inner awareness is different from the energy of pride. Self-awareness of one's true value is characterized by lack of defensiveness. Once we have consciously contacted the truth of our real beingness, the nature of our inner self with all of its true innocence, greatness, and nobility of the human spirit, we no longer need pride. We just know what we are, and this self-knowledge is sufficient for us. That which we truly know never needs defense and is different from the energy of pride that we are discussing in this chapter. Let's look at some of the kinds of pride with which we have been programmed and see how they bear up under examination. Pride of family, pride of country, and pride of accomplishment are typical examples that come to mind. Is pride really the loftiest of human emotions? The very fact that it is characterized by defensiveness proves otherwise. When we have pride in our possessions, or in some organizations with which we identify, we feel obligated to defend them. Pride in our ideas and opinions leads to endless arguments, conflict, and woe. A higher feeling state than pride is that of love. If we love all of the things noted above, family, country, accomplishments, that means there is no question of their worth in our mind. We no longer have to be on the defensive. When true recognition and knowledge replace opinion, which is part of pride, there is no room for argument. Our sheer love and appreciation for something is a solid position that cannot be assailed. Pride, because it is a vulnerable position, always implies that somewhere there is a doubt that needs to be cleared up, and the opponent quickly centers on that doubt. When all doubts have been removed, opinions and pride disappear. There is a subtle inference of apology in pride, as though the thing in itself was not good enough to stand on its own merit. That which is worthy of our love and respect hardly needs an apologist. Pride infers subtly that there is room for debate and that the worth of something is open to question. When we truly love something, and thereby become one with it, it is because we see its intrinsic perfection. In fact, its faults are part and parcel of its perfection, for all that we see in the universe is in the process of becoming. In that process, its perfect evolution is part of that perfection. Thus, the half-unfolded flower is not an imperfect flower that needs defense. On the contrary, its blossoming is proceeding with precise perfection according to the laws of the universe. Likewise, each and every individual on the planet is unfolding, growing, learning, and reflecting that same perfection. We might say that the unfoldment of the evolutionary process is proceeding precisely according to cosmic laws. One of the drawbacks about the position of pride, as we have said, is its vulnerability. Vulnerability then invites attack. Therefore, in society, we witness that prideful people draw criticism, and their vulnerability is what accounts for the saying, "Pride goeth before a fall." In the biblical account, it was Lucifer's pride that was his Achilles' heel, despite the great standing that he had acquired. Humility. The attempt to suppress pride out of guilt simply does not work. It is not helpful to label the energy of pride a sin and to suppress it in ourselves out of guilt, to hide it, or to pretend that we do not experience it. What happens is that the energy subtly takes on a new form, known as spiritual pride. We do not feel comfortable in the presence of those who are prideful. Therefore, pridefulness blocks communication and the expression of love. Although we love those who are prideful about specific accomplishments, we love them in spite of their pride and not because of it. Feeling guilty about pride as a spiritual sin only locks it in, and as we have said, is not really the answer. The real answer is merely to let go of it by examining its true nature. Once we see pride for what it is one of the easier emotions to surrender. To begin with, we can ask ourselves, what is the purpose of pride? What is its payoff? Why do I seek it? For what does it compensate? What do I have to realize about my true nature in order to let pride go without a feeling of loss? The answer is rather obvious. The smaller we feel within, the more we have to compensate for an inner sense of inadequacy, unimportance, and valuelessness, by the substitution of the emotion of pride. The more we surrender our negative emotions, the less we will rely on the crutch of pride. In its place, there will be a quality that the world calls humility, and that we subjectively experience as peacefulness. True humility is distinct from the paradox of pride in one's humility, or false modesty, seen frequently in the public arena. False modesty is the pretense of self-diminishment with the longing that others will recognize the accomplishments that one is so proud of, but too proud to brag about openly. True humility cannot be experienced by the person who is said to possess it, because it is not an emotion. As we have said before, the truly humble cannot be humbled. They are immune to humiliation. They have nothing to defend. There is no vulnerability, and therefore, the truly humble do not experience critical attacks by others. Instead, a truly humble person sees the critical verbalization by another person as merely a statement of the other person's inner problems. For instance, if somebody were to say, "You think you're pretty good, don't you?" What the truly humble person would see is that the other person has a problem with envy, and the question has no basis in reality in the first place. There is nothing to be offended by, and no need to react. In contrast, for a prideful person, this question would be viewed as an insult and lead to hurt feelings, verbal comeback, or even a violent end in some cases. Joy and gratitude. Because pride is sometimes seen as a motivator of achievement, what would be its higher-level substitute? One answer would be joy. What is wrong with joy as the reward for successful achievement, rather than pride? Pride carries with it the desire for recognition from others, and consequently, there is a vulnerability to anger and disappointment if it is not forthcoming at some point. If we achieve a certain goal for the pleasure, enjoyment, love of accomplishment, and the inner joy that it brings to us, we are invulnerable to the reaction of others. We can recognize our proneness to pain by looking at the kind of reactions we are hoping to elicit from others by our choices and behavior. This includes mannerisms, expressions, style of dress, the kind of possessions we choose, the brand name of the car we drive, the kind of home we have, the address at which we live, the schools we have attended or which our children attend, or the labels on the products we buy. In fact, if we look at our current society, we see to what an absurd degree this pridefulness has taken place. Labels are now worn on the outside of many clothes and personal articles. It hasn't reached the level of rakes and shovels yet, but it could, sooner or later. Nobody has thought of it yet, but we could all carry around rakes and shovels ostentatiously with designer names emblazoned upon them. This points to another one of the drawbacks of pride, the exploitability to which it exposes us. Pridefulness means that we can be manipulated with great ease. In return for an absurdity, a great deal of money is lifted out of our pocketbooks. The situation is currently comical in that people take great pride in how much they have been exploited. It is a current status symbol among certain circles to brag about how much one has paid for certain things. When we remove the glamour from it, we might say that the person was sort of stupid. They really got suckered in, or they were naive and just didn't know any better. The pride of snobbishness is probably the most supercilious of all. Does ostentation really impress? Actually, no. The response that we see is one of fascination. People get a charge out of the superficial glamour, but underneath they do not truly respect it, because they know what it really is. When we settle for the pridefulness of ostentation, we impress no one. This dynamic revealed itself during a trip to Canada to visit the home of a wealthy individual who subtly conveyed the price tag of his many possessions. On the same trip, malnourished Canadian Indian children were seen playing around the huge grain elevators that were filled to overflowing, the grain being held there to manipulate a higher world price through artificial creation of a shortage. As this wealthy person talked of his possessions, images of the children with their thin little legs flashed to mind. Far from being impressed with his wealth, there was sorrow for his sense of values and compassion for the lack of self-worth that forced him to compensate in such a pathetic superficiality. Does that mean that we cannot take pleasure in expensive possessions? No, not at all. What we are talking about is pride. The problem is not that we have possessions, but that we have a prideful, possessive, and self-congratulatory attitude about them. It is the attitude of pride that creates the space for fear. The same wealthy man in Canada mentioned above also had an expensive burglar alarm system. Pride, like all the other negative emotions, engenders guilt. Guilt engenders fear. Fear means potential loss. Pride, therefore, always means a loss of peace of mind. The opposite of prideful acquisitiveness is simplicity. Simplicity does not mean poverty of possessions. Rather, it is a state of mind. Another individual is worth millions of dollars, and she holds title to vast estates and possessions. Yet, as a person, she represents absolute simplicity. Her possessions reflect what the world has brought to her, and she takes joy in their beauty. Consequently, never a single criticism is made of her, nor do others express envy. It is not what we have that matters, but how we hold it, how we frame it in our consciousness, and its meaning to us. Incidentally, this woman's entire estate is totally devoid of burglar alarms or watchdogs. In fact, when this was brought to her attention, she replied, "Oh, heavens, if somebody really needed something that much, they could have it." There was a correspondence between the fact that nobody ever stole anything from her and the fact that she was willing to share with others. Her invulnerability to theft was related to her lack of pridefulness about her possessions. Possessiveness and attachment occur as a consequence of pride. Attachment is, therefore, a potential cause for suffering, because attachment brings about fear of loss, and with loss we go back into apathy, depression, and grief. If we are prideful of a car and somebody steals it, we will experience anguish, pain, and suffering. If, instead, we loosely hold the car, emotionally speaking, and we enjoy its beauty and perfection, and we feel grateful for having it, its loss will bring about only minor disappointment. Gratitude is one of the antidotes of pride. If we happen to be born with a high IQ, we can be grateful for it, rather than take pride in it. It's not an accomplishment. We were born with it. If we are grateful for what has been given us, and for what has been fulfilled through our God-given talents and endeavors, then we are in a peaceful state of mind and invulnerable to pain. It is a comical curiosity of the human mind to watch how it attaches pride to anything that is prefixed by the word mine. We can have absurd pride over the most trivial things, and once we see the comedy of that, it is not too difficult to let go of the pride involved. Some people, ironically, have the vulnerability of reverse snobbery. They take pride in bargains and thrift store conquests. Their personal opinion of people who pay excessive prices for things is that they are sheep to be sheared, and they rehearse the quote, "A fool is soon parted from his money." In this thrift store snobbery crowd, the status symbol is the incredible bargain. In fact, they are often in competition with each other to see who will find the best bargains. It is funny to observe that an article of clothing hanging in a thrift shop has no value at all until it becomes mine. Instantly, great value is attached to it. The difficult side of prefixing things with the word mine is the pride that goes with that sense of ownership. This makes us feel called upon to defend everything we label as mine. We can reduce our vulnerability by letting go of the desire to possess. Instead of saying mine, we can use the word a, not my shirt, but a shirt. Thus, we will notice that if we view one of our thoughts as an opinion instead of my opinion, the feeling tone changes. Why do people get so hot under the collar about their opinions? It is just because of that sense of mine. If opinions are viewed instead as only an opinion, then there is no longer the vulnerability to prideful anger. Opinions. If we look at opinions, we will see that they are a dime a dozen. Everybody on the street has thousands of opinions on thousands of subjects, and their opinions change from moment to moment and are vulnerable to every passing whim of fashion, propaganda, and fadism. Today's in opinion is tomorrow's out opinion. This morning's opinion is passé by afternoon. We can ask ourselves, Do I want to spread out my vulnerability to attack by so extensively identifying with all these passing thoughts and calling them mine? Everybody has an opinion on everything. So what? When we look at the true quality of opinions, we will stop giving them as much value. If we look back on our life, we will see that every mistake we ever made was based on an opinion. We become much less vulnerable if we put our thoughts, ideas, and beliefs, which are all opinions, into a different context. We can view them as ideas that we like or dislike. Some thoughts give us pleasure, and so we like them. Just because we like them today doesn't mean we have to go to war over them. We like a concept so long as it serves us, and we are getting enjoyment out of it. Of course, we discard it quite readily when it is no longer a source of pleasure. When we look at our opinions, we will see that it is primarily our emotions that are giving them any value in the first place. Instead of feeling pride about our thoughts, what is wrong with just loving them? Why not just love a certain concept because of its beauty, because of its inspirational quality, or because of its serviceability? If we view our thoughts that way, we no longer need the pride of being right. If we hold the same view of our likes and dislikes, we are no longer prone to argumentativeness. For instance, if we love the music of a certain composer, we no longer need to defend it. We might hope that our companion would also love it, but if not, the worst that we can feel is mild disappointment at not being able to share something that we personally value and enjoy. If we try this, we will find that people no longer attack our likes and dislikes and concepts. Instead of defensiveness, what they are getting from us now is appreciation. They understand that we appreciate certain things, and that is why we think the way we do. But they will no longer criticize or attack us. The worst we will get is perhaps a kidding or a quizzical attitude. Where pride is absent, attack is also absent. This is very valuable in those areas, such as politics and religion, which are so historically prone to elicit argument that they are tactically bypassed in polite society. We will find that if we love our religion, whatever it might be, no one will attack us. If we are prideful, however, we will have to avoid the entire subject because anger will quickly arise as a byproduct of the pride. When we truly value something, we lift it aloft out of the demeaning target range of argument. That which we truly cherish and revere is protected by our own reverence. If we tell somebody that we do something because we get enjoyment out of it, there is really nothing much they can say about it, is there? If we infer that we do it because we are right in doing it, we will instantly see their hackles go up, because they also have an opinion on what is right. Our values are preferences. We hold them because we love them, enjoy them, and get pleasure from them. If we hold them in that context, we will be left in peace to enjoy them. The reason that pride arouses attack is because of the inference of being better than, which is part and parcel of pride. We see many people with dietary regimens about which they are prideful. Consequently, they are in constant arguments over the rightness of their dietary regimens and nutritional opinions. They even try to impose their regimens on family members and friends, touting the moral or health superiority of their dietary practice. In contrast, there are people who follow the same regimens because they enjoy doing so, because it makes them feel better, or because it fulfills certain spiritual disciplines. Consequently, they are never heard to be in argument, because they have nothing to defend. If someone tells us that they eat the way they eat because they enjoy it, there is nothing much we can say about it, is there? If, on the other hand, they infer that theirs is the right way of eating, and by inference that ours is wrong, what they are really saying is that they are better than we are. That always arouses resentment. If we don't take a prideful stance about our opinions, then we are at liberty to change them. How often have we gotten stuck in performing something we really didn't want to do because we had foolishly taken a prideful stance on an opinion? Very often, we would like to have changed our mind or the direction in which we were going, but we got ourselves boxed in by having taken a prideful position. That brings up one of the resistances to surrendering pride, and that is pride itself. In the prideful position, one of the underlying problems is fear. We fear that if we change our position in a certain matter, the opinion of others about us will be adversely affected. One reason for the need for humility about our opinions is because our opinions change as we get deeper and deeper into any given subject or situation. What seems to be so, upon superficial examination, often turns out to be quite different when we really get into it. This, of course, is to the dismay of the politician, who makes promises based on fantasies of what is possible. But as he assumes power, he finds that matters are quite different than he had thought. The problems are far more complex. The situation is really due to the net effect of many powerful forces in society. All that politicians can truly promise us is that they will use the best possible judgment for the good of all, as they get deeper into each matter. This evolutionary aspect of life is really all that any of us can promise ourselves, and this self-knowledge will protect us from disillusionment. This is the safety of the open mind position, or what is called beginner's mind in Zen practice. When we are open-minded, we are admitting that we are not in possession of all the facts, and we are ready to change our opinions as the situation unfolds. In this way, we do not box ourselves into the pain of defending lost causes. This is very true even in areas we think are based on strictly factual and observable data, such as the field of science. Actually, science deals with hypotheses, and scientific opinion is constantly in the process of flux and change. Scientific opinion, much to the surprise of laypersons, is also subject to fads, passing popularity, paradigm blindness, and political pressure. For instance, in the field of psychiatry, the subject of the relationship between nutrition, blood chemistry, brain function, and mental illness was not popular in the past. The scientists and clinicians who worked in this area found themselves in the out group. As time passed, and it proved that there was value in this field of investigation, popular scientific opinion changed. Important discoveries were made, and whole industries came into being to provide products which utilized the basic findings of the relationship between nutrition and brain function. The subject is now accepted as respectable, so clinicians and scientists can do research in that area and be accepted as part of the in-group. Pride, therefore, is also responsible for holding up scientific progress, e.g., global warming theories. Pride blinds us to many things that would be profoundly beneficial. To a prideful mind, to accept them would be inferring that we are wrong. The more inwardly powerful we really are, the more flexible we become, so that we are open to all that is beneficial. Pride prevents us from seeing that which is totally obvious. People die by the thousands because of pride. They literally give up their health and life itself. Addicts and alcoholics will go to their death because of the denial inherent in pride. Other people have the problem, not me. Pride prevents us from recognizing our own limitations and accepting the help we need to overcome them. Our pridefulness isolates us. When we let go of pride, help comes into our life to address the problems with which we are struggling. We can experiment and prove the truth of that principle by picking one area in which we are having difficulty and thoroughly surrendering all the pride involved. When we do that, some surprising things begin to happen. Letting go of pride unlocks the door to our receiving that which is most beneficial to us. Are we willing to let go of pride and feeling superior to others? When we are willing to let go of the pseudo-security of pride, we experience the real security that comes with courage, self-acceptance, and joy. Chapter 10. Courage. The hallmark of courage is the knowledge and feeling, I can. It is a positive state in which we feel assured, skillful, adequate, capable, alive, loving, and giving, with an overall zest for life. We are capable of humor, activity, confidence, and clarity. In this state, we feel centered, balanced, flexible, happy, independent, and self-sufficient. We can be inventive, creative, and open. In courage, there is a lot of energy, action, letting go, capacity to be there, to be spontaneous, resilient, resourceful, and cheerful. In this state, we can be very effective in the world. The courage to let go. The level of courage is very helpful in the mechanism of surrender. In courage, we know, I can look at my feelings. I don't have to be afraid of my feelings anymore. I can handle them. I can take responsibility for them. I can learn how to accept them and be free from them. I am willing to take risks, to let go of old points of view, and to explore new ones. I am willing to be joyous and share my experience with others. I experience myself as willing and able. It is often easy to jump from any of the lower feelings up to courage merely by affirming our courage to look at and handle our feelings. The mere willingness to look at and begin to handle them increases our self-esteem. If, for instance, we have a fear and are unwilling to look at it, then we feel diminished and our self-esteem is lowered. If we are willing to look at that fear, examine it, acknowledge its presence, see how it has inhibited our life, and begin to surrender it, then our self-esteem increases, whether the fear disappears or not. We all know that it takes courage to face fear. We champion the people who face their fear and attempt to do something about it. Such courage is one of the characteristics of nobility and makes a person truly great. Despite all of their negative programming and despite all of their fear, courageous people go forward in life with no guarantee and not even the knowledge that things are going to get better. So courage increases our self-respect and brings to us the respect of others. We no longer need to feel ashamed. Let's look at the example of a man who suffered from a lifelong terror of heights. He had worked on being free of the fear for several years, and it had gotten much better, but there was still plenty of it left. This was evident when he went to the Grand Canyon with a friend. At first, he stood back about 6 feet from the ledge. In previous years, he wouldn't have gone within a block of it. Now he stood there, hesitantly. The friend took his hand, saying, "Come on over to the edge with me." And so he did. He kept surrendering on the fear as he walked forward and found that he could actually stand right next to the edge, although admittedly not without still feeling considerable discomfort. When they left the edge of the canyon, the friend looked at him approvingly and said, "Well, at least you did it. I know how much courage that took." Even though he had not totally overcome the fear, by transcending an inner barrier, he had earned his own self-respect and the respect of others. When we have these breakthrough experiences, we begin to perceive our fear differently, and we stop being ashamed of it. We stop allowing it to invalidate our true worth. It increases our inner strength and our self-approval. In due time, the underlying fears, which require courage to overcome, diminish to the point that we move on to acceptance. Self-empowerment. On the level of courage, the emphasis is on doing. We already know that we are capable of providing for our own needs and for those of others, and we know that, if we are willing to put forth the effort, we can obtain what we want. Thus, people on the level of courage are the doers of the world. Because we can only give away what we ourselves already have, people on the level of courage are able to be supportive and encouraging of others. This is because they are able to give as well as receive, and there is a balance between giving and receiving that occurs naturally. The levels of consciousness up to this point are concerned primarily with gain. Now, on the level of courage, there is greater power and energy. We have the ability to give to others because other people are no longer being looked at primarily as a means of help, survival, or support. When we are in the state of courage, we sense our own inner power, strength, and self-worth. We know that we have the capacity to make a difference in the world, not just gain something from it for ourselves. Because of the inner self-confidence, we are much less concerned with security. The emphasis is no longer on what people have, but upon what they do and have become. With courage, there is the willingness to take chances and to let go of former securities. There is the willingness to grow and benefit from new experiences. This involves the capacity to admit mistakes without indulging in guilt and self-recrimination. Our sense of self-worth is not diminished by looking at areas that need improvement. We are able to admit the presence of problems without being diminished. As a result, energy, time, and effort are put into self-improvement. On this level, statements of intention and purpose are much more powerful, and envisioned results tend to manifest. We are much more enterprising and creative because our energies are not drained by the constant preoccupation with emotional or physical survival. Because of greater flexibility, there is a willingness to examine issues with a view to changing overall meaning and context. There is a willingness to risk shifting paradigms. A paradigm is a whole worldview, and it is only limited by what we view as possible. As old ways of looking at things are challenged, our worldview begins to stretch and expand. That which was previously considered to be impossible becomes possible and eventually is experienced as a new dimension of reality. There is the capacity to look within ourselves, to examine our belief systems, ask questions, and seek new solutions. On the level of courage, we are willing to take self-improvement courses, learn consciousness techniques, and risk the journey within to seek our own true self, the inner reality. There is a willingness to experience uncertainty, periods of confusion, and temporary upset because underneath the temporary discomfort, we have a long-term transcendent goal. The mind that is operating on the level of courage makes such statements as, "I can handle it. We'll make it. The job will get done. We can see this through. All things shall pass." If we test a person's muscle strength with kinesiology, when in the state of courage, the level of "I can handle it," they will test positive and remain strong to our challenge. Although there is still vulnerability to negative thoughts or energies, such as those that emanate from fluorescent lights or artificial sweeteners, the bioenergy field is more radiant than that of the lower, negative states. Because courage is a stronger, more resilient energy field, physical illnesses are less likely to be a predominant aspect of life. There may be chronic residuals of illnesses that originated from the lower levels of consciousness, but they are generally not stabilized. In courage, there is an overall sense of strength and well-being. Awareness of others. The lifestyle on this level shows a balance of work, enjoyment, and love. There is not the necessity for overambition or workaholism. Although people on the level of courage are capable of considerable energy output if the situation requires it. Because of the letting go of so much negativity, there is a desire and a capacity to love and to have loving relationships. These now assume equal importance with efforts toward survival. There is vocational security, and in the work area, there is concern for the welfare of others. People on this level characteristically state that they want jobs which will be of some benefit to the world. They want to feel that there is more meaning to their job than just a salary. Personal growth is important, and there is the awareness on this level that our life is either positively or negatively influencing those around us. On the lower levels of consciousness, which are characterized by egotism, there is so much concern with self-gain that there is little energy or thought given to our effect on others. On the level of courage, we no longer identify solely with the small self. The world is no longer seen as the depriving or punishing bad parent. Instead, the world is seen as challenging and presenting opportunities for growth, development, and new experiences. Thus, this level is characterized by optimism and the feeling that with the correct facts, education, and orientation, sooner or later, most problems can be worked out satisfactorily. The lower levels limit our consciousness to personal concern, but on this level, social issues become important, and energy is expended to help overcome social problems and to be helpful to those less fortunate. Therefore, generosity becomes possible, not just financially, but also in a generosity of attitude. Pleasure is derived from the championing of causes and from supporting the endeavors of others. This energy creates new jobs, businesses, industries, and political and scientific solutions. Education, although not always in the academic sense, becomes important. On the level of courage, we really start becoming conscious. It dawns on us that we have the freedom and the capacity to choose. We no longer have to be the victim, and freedom in the psychological, emotional, and spiritual sense is possible. Therefore, much less rigidity is present, and because of flexibility and the capacity of concern and genuine love for others, people on this level make good parents, bosses, employees, and citizens. There is a capacity to put ourselves in another's place, and a concern for the feelings of others, as well as their overall welfare. Although the lower negative feelings still tend to occur, they do not predominate or determine one's lifestyle. That is, we do it even though we're scared. People on this level are the backbone of the country. They are the people we turn to when it is necessary to do so for the common good. They are dependable and can be counted on because of their willingness to accept responsibility. On this level, there is a social conscience and humanitarianism. As the basis of moral decisions, guilt takes a back seat to the welfare of others. It is from this level that we get such sayings as, success breeds success. Because of adequate functioning, there is positive feedback, which reinforces confidence and allows greater self-exploration as well as exploration of the world. Although effort is still required to accomplish goals, it is much less than on the lower levels. There is greater satisfaction and gratification because there is greater reward with less effort than that which would be required to overcome fear. There is much greater capacity not only to seek help, but to be able to utilize it and benefit from it. Money is used in a much more constructive manner, and there is concern with how the expenditures will affect the lives of others. Money is not spent solely for self-gratification, self-aggrandizement, or self-fortification. Rather, it is seen as a tool for accomplishment. This level is the one at which true spiritual awareness becomes possible. Because of the emergence from egotism and the relinquishment of the identification with the small self, there is an experiencing of higher energies and the hope of increased awareness. On the lower levels, God is viewed from the emotional coloration of that level. Thus, in apathy, the whole relationship with God is hopeless, if it can be considered at all. On the level of grief, one feels hopelessly separated from any help from God. When overcome with guilt, the person feels undeserving of any relationship with God, and punishment is expected rather than love. On the level of fear, the fear may be so great that the problem of God cannot even be faced, so that the subject is blotted out of consciousness and God is viewed as fearful, punishing, avenging, jealous, and angry. On the level of anger, God is viewed as depriving, arbitrary, capricious, and failing. On the level of pride, there is egotism about one's religious or spiritual position, characterized by rigidity, inflexibility, intolerance, proneness to exclusivity, bigotry, clannishness, religious argumentation, and warring. On the level of courage, we are willing to take responsibility for our religious or spiritual position. The increased awareness often results in the emergence of the spiritual seeker, and the pursuit of truth in its religious or spiritual sense truly awakens. This may result in a reaffirmation of our previous position, but now from a totally new viewpoint, that of choice. It may bring about changes, which may be either slow and gradual or sudden. On this level, there is the awakening of consciousness and the realization that our beliefs and views are now a result of our choice, not just a result of previous blind programming. There is a search for meaning, and this may occur on the level of ethics and humanitarianism rather than in the area specifically denoted as formal religion. We investigate our social function and role in the world, and we inquire as to the value of our lives, not only to ourselves, but also to others. Carl Jung said that the healthy personality is equally balanced between work, play, love, and an aspect of personality called spirituality, which we could also define as the search for meaning and value. These investigations bring inner upsets, but also moments of acceptance and peace. There are moments of intuitive understanding which beckon us on to continue the quest, to find out if there is anything beyond just the physical and material world and its ever-changing phenomena. This level of consciousness is a good one from which to look at and let go of more negative feelings. On this level, we have the energy, capacity, self-confidence, and willingness to acquire know-how and undergo the necessary steps of learning. On this level, there is a desire for self-improvement and the realization that better states of mind are possible. The level of courage knows that it is not necessary to endure the pain and suffering of the negative emotions or their interference with the satisfactions of life. In courage, we are no longer willing to pay the cost of negativity. We are concerned about the effects of our negative feelings on the welfare of others with whom we are closely associated. Most people who have learned the letting go technique will continue to use it until they have reached this level of consciousness. On this level, their major life problems are now under control. They are experiencing vocational satisfaction and success. Material wants are supplied. Major problems in relationships have straightened out. They are no longer consciously experiencing pain and suffering, and there is satisfaction from having grown and developed in certain areas. When we are comfortable, there is a temptation to stop using the technique and only resume it in emergency situations, or when negative feelings again become painful and necessitate our attention. However, there is more yet to be had. Because there is always a feeling going on which can be surrendered, the continuation of the process will lead to greater and greater benefits. Continual surrender will bring about constant subtle changes, especially on the levels of subtle awareness in our capacity for love. Previously, we had likened the radiation of love, which stems from our higher aspect, to the energy of the sunlight. We noted that as the dark clouds of negativity are removed, this energy and our capacity to accept it and radiate it outward increases progressively. On the level of courage, our capacity to love is now much stronger, and it has the power to support and encourage others, lending strength to that which is positive and constructive in them. Assisting their development brings us the pleasure of watching their growth and their increasing happiness. This capacity within us can grow ever stronger. It can become ever more powerful and self-rewarding, as well as more beneficial to others. We can utilize courage to reinforce our desire to grow beyond our present state, because on this level, we are already getting inklings that there is something within us that we had hitherto unsuspected. These are indicated by those sudden episodes of perfect stillness and peace, in which we have great clarity, understanding, and heightened sensitivity to beauty. We discover that it was through the music and not because of it that we experience our mind going suddenly still, and in that moment of stillness, we were allowed to experience a greater dimension. There may be fleeting seconds in which we feel a complete identification and oneness with others, as though there were no separation. These are the moments of breaking through into the experiencing of our real inner self. The memory of those moments is never forgotten. When they first start to happen, we don't know what they mean. We think they are accidental, just due to chance. We attribute the feeling to external events such as the beauty of a sunset, a symphonic passage, or a loving gesture. But as we investigate further, we find that these were only the circumstances that allowed something else to happen. They were not the cause. They allowed a certain stillness of the mind to take place, and because of that stillness, we were allowed a moment in which we were able to experience something other than the chatter of our own mind with its incessant, restless play of sensations, feelings, thoughts, emotions, and memories. In the moments when time seems to stand still, we get a glimpse of what is possible. These moments are so rewarding that they are treasured for a lifetime. When they occur, something is experienced that is very impressive. Could it be that, beyond the turbulence of the world and our own mind, there is silence, a realm of peace that is always waiting? Chapter 11. Acceptance. In acceptance, we enjoy the experience of harmony. We feel as though events are flowing. We feel secure. We can be of service to others without a feeling of self-sacrifice. There is the feeling, I'm okay, you're okay, and it's okay. It is a feeling of belonging, connectedness, fullness, loving, understanding, and the feeling of being understood. It is a feeling of caring, warmth, and self-worth. Because of the security of this state, we can allow ourselves to be soft, mellow, and natural. There is joy, and we feel in tune and relaxed. There is the feeling that it's all right just to be ourselves. Everything is perfect as it is. In the state of acceptance, there is the feeling that nothing needs to be changed. Everything is perfect and beautiful the way it is. The world is to be enjoyed. There is compassion for others and for all living things. In this state, we are automatically nurturing and supportive of others without any feeling of sacrifice. Because of the inner security and feeling of abundance, there is generosity and ease of giving with no expectation of return or record-keeping, such as, here's what I am doing for you. When we are in a state of acceptance, we love our friends instead of being critical, and we are willing to love them in spite of their limitations, which we willingly overlook. The way people appear to us from this space is that everyone is actually doing the best they can with what they have at the moment. We see that all of life is evolving towards its perfection, and we are in sync with the laws of the universe and consciousness. In this state, we really begin to understand love. On the level of acceptance, love is experienced as a stable state, a permanent condition of a relationship. The source of love is seen to be within ourselves, emanating from our own nature and reaching out to include others. In the state of desire, by contrast, we speak of being in love as the source of happiness, and love is thought to be outside of ourselves. When we are in the lower energy level of desire, we are looking to be loved. It seems to be something we get. On the level of acceptance, however, our lovingness radiates out naturally from the essence of our being, because many of the blocks to its awareness have been surrendered. We discover that this lovingness is our inner nature, and that it appears spontaneously and automatically when the blocks are removed. This is what the great teachers mean by our true inner essence, our true self. It is the aim of our inner self to transcend the ego, that composite of all our negative feelings, programs, and thoughts, so that we are able to experience the inner essential nature. There are many pathways that carry us to the state of acceptance, and this is the gateway which leads eventually to the next highest states, described as the consciousness levels of love and peace. To many people who have been surrendering for periods of time, this ultimate objective progressively supersedes all others. To dwell in states of unconditional love and imperturbable peace becomes the inner aim, more important than any other achievement. Acceptance of self and others. On the level of acceptance, because of the major change in the way we perceive others, we now become aware of the inner innocence behind the frantic, fear-driven struggles that have obscured it in ourselves and in our neighbors, friends, and family. The great teachers have said that the negativity which we see in a person or in society is really due to blindness, ignorance, and unconsciousness. This inner innocence, once it is perceived in others, is also perceived in ourselves. All that we did was done because we just didn't know any better at the time. If we had known a better way at the time, we would have done it that way. It seemed like a good idea at the time, we say. We see that same blindness operating in others, and we can look past their character defects and see the innocent child within. Once we see our innocence, there is an identification with others and a loss of feeling alone and stressed. We are able to see innocence even behind the most rash and apparently horrible behaviors. We look inside a person and see the frightened animal that just doesn't know any better. We are aware that, if cornered, it will surely attack us and bite. It just doesn't realize that our intentions are peaceful, and so it flails out wildly. In the state of acceptance, it is possible to forgive our own past, as well as that of others, and to heal past resentments. It is also possible to see the hidden gift in past events about which we have been resentful, including their possible karmic significance. From this level, it is possible to create a different context from which to view the past and thereby heal it. With the final completion of the level of acceptance, we feel secure about the future and can move on to the levels of love and peace. Reason and logic become tools for the fulfillment of that potential. Another characteristic of the level of acceptance is that we are no longer concerned with moralistic judgment, with good and bad. It just becomes obvious what works and what doesn't work. It is easy to see what is destructive and what is optimal, without judging anything as evil. There is the elimination of guilt, which accompanies all judgments against others and ourselves. We then see the meaning of the statement, "Judge not, lest ye be judged." In acceptance, we have let go of the inner guilt-monger that found fault with even our most basic human drives. We can enjoy our physicality without moralistic aversion or compulsive self-gratification. We accept that others have come to their understanding of life and their ethical views in a way that makes sense to them, even if their beliefs and behaviors are quite different from ours. When we see the innocence in everyone, we can truly fulfill loving our neighbor as ourselves. And thus, letting go has allowed us to reach a lofty goal without even the conscious attempt to do so. The level of acceptance is characterized by the attitude of selflessness and service. This results from the surrendering of the negative feelings that create the small self, which removes our identification with it. Instead, inner harmony and peace are experienced as the nature of our greater self. Because the negative programs have been relinquished, there is the emergence of greater creativity, inspiration, and intuition. There is certainty that our own personal needs will be met. Therefore, there is a shift in relationship so that the focus is on the welfare and happiness of others. This is facilitated by the fact that at this level, there is no longer neediness in the form of dependency on other people, because there is nothing we feel we need to get from them. In a relationship of loving acceptance, minor imperfections are no longer given serious importance and are overlooked. In acceptance, there is a decreased preoccupation with doingness, a growing focus on the quality of beingness itself and the perfection of our own inner capacity for caring and lovingness. Although negative feelings may still arise, they are less and less frequent and are handled with greater ease. In general, functioning is now easy, and the daily activities become hardly noticeable because of their effortlessness. Personal responsibility. The hallmark of this state is the taking of responsibility for our own consciousness. Interest in meditation and the various methods of inner contemplation is common. Spiritual and ethical matters become important. We may, for instance, attend religious retreats if we are religious, or we may engage in spiritual or humanitarian endeavors if we are oriented toward those spheres. The world is seen to be harmonious, and any alteration of that appearance is realized to be a projection onto it of our own inner conflicts. On this level, there is the awareness that all negative feelings are our own problem, and there is no longer looking outside of ourselves for their resolution. There is a seriousness regarding the growth of our own consciousness and self-awareness, and a focus on honing the quality of that consciousness itself. On this level, we may begin to develop an interest in the philosophy, scientific research, and spiritual classics that explore the highest potential of human mind and spirit. What becomes increasingly important is what we are becoming, not what we have or do. On this level, we take on the challenge of fulfilling our greatest inner potential and nurturing the potential and dreams of others. If muscle tested in this state, we test strong. We are relatively immune to negative influences, such as the weakening vibrations of fluorescent lights, synthetic fabrics, or artificial sweeteners. There is a strong commitment to health and wellness and bettering ourselves on all levels. Health issues are often considered to be problems at the psychological, emotional, or mental levels, and resources are sought and found which help to resolve these